You're out on the roadmap. You have uncertainty, not just in sizing, but in whether you will implement those features. Walk through the entire backlog, estimating as you proceed. Don't worry about how large the features are. Keep a count of those large features. Decide as a team if this feature is larger than 2 or 3 team days. If it is, keep a count of those features. The larger the features, the more uncertainty you have in your estimate. As a team, add all your relative estimates for your features. Add up the number of large features. Now you have a relative estimate, which, based on your previous velocity, means something to you. You also have a number of large features, which will decrease the confidence in that estimate. Do you have 50 features, of which only 5 are large? Maybe you have 75% confidence in your estimate. On the other hand, maybe all of your features are large. I might have only 5 to 10% confidence in the estimate. Why? Because the team hasn't completed any work yet, and you have no idea how long your work will take. Figure 9.1 in the supplemental materials reflects what this might look like on a program. Assume you have 5 teams, each with its own ranked backlog. Each team assesses their backlog and turns it into an estimate with a percentage confidence level. In this example, you have teams with confidence levels ranging from 10% to 90%. That says the backlog items are not small enough for the teams to estimate a reasonable size, or that there is so much risk that the teams can't provide you a more precise estimate. You might want to know, when will this program be done? But you can't know it without the teams doing some work. As a software program team, get together and assess the total estimate. Does the software program team need to add time for any current obstacles? If so, add time and increase the percentage uncertainty. Once the software program team has some kind of an estimate, the software program manager can bring that estimate to the core program team. In parallel to the software program estimation, the core team needs to generate their estimates for their plans. Once everyone has estimates, the core team can assess how long they will take as a core team, and the software program manager can present the software program estimate. Now the core team can review the entire estimate and generate a number for the people who asked for an estimate. 9.4.2. Option 2. Ask experts to estimate on behalf of the teams. If you have a roadmap, but have not assigned feature teams yet, consider asking experts in the organization. They will have estimation bias. You don't know how much estimation bias they have. Ask the experts to estimate on behalf of the teams using the same percentage confidence approach above. When you report the number to management, explain that you do not know how much estimation bias there is in the estimate. Your sponsors would be better off letting the teams work for a couple of weeks and seeing results. They could then answer the questions. How much would you like to invest before we stop? What is the value of this project or program to you? An estimate from experts may not even be in order of magnitude correct. 9.4.3. Option 3. You estimate on behalf of the entire program. When my managers have asked me for a program estimate, I ask them if they have a target date in mind. I remind them that we are working incrementally and we can change. I remind them that I am a program manager and I have no ability to see into the future. I remind them that I can help the teams produce working product often, but asking me for a date is not going to make that occur faster. If you say something like this nicely, and it depends on your culture as to how you say it, you may be able to understand what your sponsors or managers do want. If your organization is new to Agile, your managers might not realize that the product owners are in charge of when a feature is scheduled in the backlog. Never allow a target date to compromise the quality of your program. Maintaining technical excellence allows the teams to maintain their sustainable pace and keep releasing internally and externally. Both options 2 and 3 have problems. If anyone estimates on behalf of the teams may have no interest in committing to that estimate. Why would they? All too often, managers use the estimates that other people create as a target or incentive for the feature teams. That is a terrible way to use these estimates. The teams have no control over their work. Can the team sustain their pace to meet these estimates? Can the teams work as self-organizing teams to deliver? When someone else provides teams with a target and then tries to force a commitment to that target, you know that Murphy's Law is going to sit on your program and make it impossible for the teams to deliver working features in the desired time. Don't do it. 9.5. Present your estimate as a prediction. I assume you have experienced agile teams. If not, the teams have probably padded their estimates. Either that, or the features are large epics or themes, and the uncertainty is high. The more experienced the teams are at Agile, the better the estimate is. The more the teams are feature teams, the better the estimate is because the teams know how to work and learn together. If you're new to Agile or have a mixed program, Agile and non-Agile teams, you know that the estimate will be way off. The software program manager can say, "We have an initial order of magnitude prediction, but we haven't tested this prediction with any work, so we don't know how accurate our estimates are. Right now, our confidence is about 5 to 10%, or whatever it is, in our prediction. We've spent a day or so estimating because we would rather spend time delivering instead of estimating. We need to do a week or two of work, deliver a working skeleton, and then we can tell you more about our prediction. We can better our prediction as we proceed. Remember back in the waterfall days, we spent a month estimating, and we were wrong. This way, you'll get to see product as we work." Use the word prediction as much as possible because people understand the word prediction. They hear weather predictions all the time. They know about weather predictions. But when they hear estimates of work, they think you're correct. Even if you use confidence numbers, they think you're accurate. Use the word prediction. Consider setting your management's expectations by saying, "Here's a prediction for our first milestone, internal release. We can provide a much better estimate for the next milestone. Incremental estimation works as well as incremental budgeting does." 9.6. Spiral in on an estimate. Spiraling in on a date works quite well for smaller, shorter programs. I've used this approach for 4 to 8 month programs. I offer quarter two next year as my first estimate. As we finish features and have internal releases, I update the estimate to February through March. As we finish work, and I can see how we deliver, I can say the first couple of weeks in March, sometime. As we finish more work, I can work with the program product owner to see if we still have remaining value in the roadmap and if we need to ask teams to work outside their normal deliverables to make that date. 9.7. Supply a three-date estimate. With a three-date estimate, you offer your managers this information. The earliest possible date the teams might complete the program. This is the optimistic date. A more likely date the teams might complete. This is the realistic date. A date by which you are sure the teams can complete the program. This is the pessimistic date. Never supply just one date with your estimate. That one date invites your management to play estimation games with you. When you supply a three-date estimate, you invite them to understand your risks. The longer the program, the farther out your realistic and pessimistic dates should be. When I have used this, I have said, "We should have a demonstrable overall product by June 1st, but I don't think we can release that one to our customers. We should have a reasonable delivery date of August 15th. If Murphy comes to sit in on our program, don't expect a releasable product until October 30th. And I should be able to update this estimate next month, when we can all see what the teams deliver." I have found that if I set my manager's expectations about what they can expect to see, they understand this kind of estimation. 9.8. Do you really need an estimate? I've worked on many programs in my professional life. My managers gave me targets for demonstrations, trade shows, and when the program had to deliver. Sometimes my managers gave me a not-to-exceed budget. I've never been asked the how-much question. That's because the program delivered monthly demonstrations or releases. Managers could see our progress. When it comes to delivering products, if you provide interim value, the how-much question goes away. Your management trusts the program to continue delivering value. Deliver internal releases. Show a walking skeleton and then keep building small features. Keep ranking backlog items by value. Keep asking the how much do you want to invest question. You won't have to estimate the entire program. 9.9. Beware of these program estimation traps. There are plenty of potential traps when you estimate programs. Here are some common problems. The backlog is full of themes. You haven't even gotten to epics, never mind stories. No one can make a useful prediction. That's like my saying, I can go from Boston to China on an airplane. It'll take time. I need more data. Which time of year? Midweek? Weekend? Otherwise, I can only provide a ballpark, not a real estimate. Any estimate anyone provides will be off by orders of magnitude, and you don't know how many. The teams will have to spend time breaking the themes into feature sets, time they could spend developing working product. Worse, the backlog is full of tasks, so you don't know the value of a story. Fix the radio button does not explain the value of a story. Maybe we can estimate the button instead of fixing it. You don't know if you have a valuable working product at the end of all the tasks. The people estimating are not the ones who will do the work, so the estimate is full of estimation bias. Just because work looks easy or looks hard does not mean it is. If your senior managers believe this estimate, they will feel disappointed and frustrated when the teams take more time than their estimators expected. The estimate becomes a target. This never works, but managers do it all the time. You estimated it would take a quarter to do this work. Prove it. Some managers do not understand that an estimate is a prediction or a guess. The people on your program multitask, so the estimate is wrong. Managers think they can predict team size from the estimate. This is the problem of splitting work in the mistaken belief that more people make it easier to do more work. More people make the communications burden heavier. Estimating a program is more difficult because you somehow have to add disparate estimates with different percentage confidences. A better way to manage the issues of a program is to decide if the program is worth funding, by value, in the project portfolio. Then work in an agile way. Be ready to change the order of work in the backlog for teams and among teams. As a program manager, you have two roles when people ask for estimates. Check with your sponsors and request the teams deliver often. Ask your sponsors the questions in Ask These Questions Before Estimating from Section 9.2. Explain to the teams and product owners the results the organization needs. A walking skeleton of features in the product and build on it. Small features so we can see the product evolve every day. The more the sponsors see the product take shape, the less interested they will be in an overall estimate. They may ask for more specific estimates. When can you do this specific feature? Which is much easier to answer. Delivering working software builds trust. Trust obviates many needs for estimates. If your managers or customers have never had trust with a project or program team before, they'll start asking for estimates. Your job is to deliver working software every day so they stop asking. 9.10. Estimation do's and don'ts for program managers. There are several do's and don'ts for estimation. Here are some common problems. 9.10.1. Estimation don'ts. Never provide a single point estimate. If you provide a single point estimate of either a date or money, people will expect that specific date or that much money. Even if you are just 10% over, they will think you have failed. I am serious. Estimating by anyone on behalf of the teams. If anyone estimates for the teams, they have no reason to meet that estimate. Why would they? Would you? Trying to enforce overtime to meet an estimate. Agile is built on the idea of sustainable pace. Disregard that at your peril. You will create technical debt, lose collaboration, and defeat the idea of autonomy and exploration. Never let managers try to add relative estimates from teams together. That's like trying to add oranges from one team and frogs from another team. You want teams to work at their own velocity or cycle time. As long as they can create features from a backlog, you don't care what they call their relative estimation. 9.10.2. estimation dues. Listen to the teams. Once they provide you with their estimates, thank them and use their estimates. Plan to iterate. This is agile. The backlogs will change, which means the estimates will change. It's your job as the program manager to explain that to your sponsors. Estimates expire. If your sponsors think that an estimate is good for all time, disabuse them of that notion. Every estimate has an expiration date. Help your sponsors see that instead of estimates. They want to see working product. For more details on estimates and what works and doesn't work, see my book, Predicting the Unpredictable, Pragmatic Approaches to Estimating Cost or Schedule. 9.11. Principles of Estimating Schedule or Cost. 1. Never add relative estimates together or compare team estimates. Every team works at a different pace. Each team's velocity is personal. The principles are working software is the primary measure of progress and simplicity. 2. Use a percentage confidence so everyone understands that, especially at the beginning of the program. You have no idea how long the program will take. The principle is business people and developers must work together. 3. Working product is better than estimation. Build working product fast. See if working product will take the place of estimates for your management. If necessary, work toward a target date or budget. The principle is, working software is the primary measure of progress. Chapter 10. Useful Measurements in an Agile and Lean Program. Part of what you might need to do in your program team meetings is to prepare your program status for the rest of the organization. You might have some sort of operations review meeting. Because the organization expects some progress in your program, you might need to show progress to the people who make project portfolio decisions. Use the information in this chapter to work with your sponsors and learn what your management requires and how you need to show your management progress. Working software is the best measure of progress. When your program delivers working product frequently, you build trust with the people who want estimates or measurements. You might need to review how often can you release your product in section 6.4. You may still have to provide a run rate or some other financial report to those folks. On the other hand, they won't worry about whether your program is worth the money they've invested. They can see the results when they see the working product. Working product builds trust in a way that any measurement does not. That may be the best status report you can provide. You want measurements that mean something useful at the program level. Consider how you might explain to anyone about what the program has completed and what remains not yet done. As always, the best measurement is working product. However, that is not the only measurement you can take that means something at the program level. Tip: working product should be your primary measurement. It is how you will see progress. 10.1. What measurements will mean something to your program? Measurements come in two flavors: predictive indicators and lagging indicators. Of course you want predictive indicators. You have a large effort. What do you have for a one-team agile project? You have velocity, burn-up charts, and cumulative flow. Can you use these measures at the program level? You cannot use velocity at the program level. It's not a predictive measure. Here's why. 10.2. Never use team-based measurements for a program. I see a ton of measurement dysfunction when it comes to large programs. Measurement is one place where if you try to say, here's what each team does, what does this mean for the program, you'll get in trouble. Do not even think about taking project team measurements and adding them together. That's like taking my husband's weight and mine, adding them together, dividing by two, and determining our average gene size. It makes just as much sense to try to determine average velocity or cumulative flow or average anything when you do that with teams. Any team-based measurement is for that team to use as their guide. 10.2.1. Do not use velocity as a program measure. Velocity is a team-based measurement. Teams can use velocity as a diagnostic tool to see how they're doing. Velocity is not a good program-level measurement. One of the mistakes I see a lot is that managers want to take several teams' velocity and somehow add them together. They think this is a program measure of velocity. Don't do that. Velocity is personal to one team. It's only predictive to that team, and it's only predictive for estimation purposes. It's not predictive to any other team. You can see what teams are doing if they are feature teams, and you use a product backlog burn-up chart. You can't use velocity to predict program progress either. Why? Because as the product owners get better at making the stories smaller, and you want them to become better at this, the number of stories may well increase per iteration. That will change a team's velocity. But what if you are a program manager or a product owner and you see a team that used to produce running tested features at a regular clip suddenly slow down? What do you do? The first question is this. Does it matter? Maybe this team is helping another team. Maybe they are so far ahead in their feature set that it doesn't matter. Do you know? Second, are you the right person to interfere? Is there someone else, a project manager, a product owner, a coach, or a scrum master who might lead a retrospective and ask these questions? If you are the correct person, here are some questions you might ask. Has the team encountered any obstacles recently that have affected their ability to produce running tested features? You can remove obstacles. Is anyone on the team multitasking? Make sure this team is dedicated to your program. That is an obstacle you can address. Has the team reviewed their velocity charts or cycle time to see what's going on? A velocity chart or cycle time chart can help a team solve their problems. The team might not realize what's happening. Once they know, the team can address this concern. Does the team need any help from you? Expect the team to be able to identify its problems. If a team knows it has a problem and can't identify it, they can ask you for help. I've seen agile teams who worked well as independent teams have trouble integrating into a program. So far, all those teams I've seen have identified their problems and needed help solving them. You can add value by suggesting ways they can find help or by acquiring the help they need. 10.3. Measure by features, not by teams. So we have team measurements that don't add up. What can we use? Feature-based measurements. Programs are all about features. That means you measure by feature. Sometimes multiple teams work off the same shared backlog. Does it matter if you measure what a team does? It matters for the team. It does not matter for the program. But the program manager cares about the program's progress on features across the teams. If the entire program has lurching progress, as in teams that are not integrating something each day, that's a problem. It means that you might have all or some of these problems. Too many features in progress. No continuous integration. And or the work in progress in the teams is too high. So how do you measure this? You could measure number of features completed per iteration. Why not story points? Because customers don't buy story points. Customers buy features. They only buy running tested features. That's it. This is where the program bumps up against the project portfolio. Now, it happens that each feature is some number of story points. And the way to make more features is to break them down into smaller slices. Yes, this is gaming the system. All measurements can be gamed, all of them. However, especially in a large effort such as a program, you want small features. You will see progress faster with minimum marketable features. So it's okay if your product owners start making smaller features. One way to make smaller features is to do what Pavel Brodzinski says in his online article, Minimum Indispensable Feature Set. The reason is that most of the time I can instantly come with the batch of work that is one-third, one-fifth, or one-tenth of what was labeled as minimal viable product by a potential client, and it would still validate a business hypothesis behind a product. It likely means that with a bit of effort and better understanding of the context, our clients would be able to cut it down way further than that. It may mean that they'd even be able to validate the basic idea without writing any software at all. Pavel Brodzinski. Note that his minimal indispensable feature set is very small. When you start measuring by features, you can create small wins. When the program can release more often, your program builds trust. 10.4. Measure completed features. If you have an Agile roadmap, you can measure the number of features done and the number of features remaining to complete against the total number of features. This provides everyone with a chance to see when the features increase and the progress made against the roadmap. The smaller the features in the roadmap, the better this chart will be. Allow for the increase of features because creating software is about learning. As the teams finish features, they and their product owners will realize they need to do something else. That's fine. Allow for it. Figure 10.1 in the supplemental materials, the program feature chart, shows that things change in a program. The roadmap will change. That means the backlogs for the teams will change. Make that visible to everyone. Otherwise, everyone wants to know, why can't you predict this program's cost? Allow for change and help other people understand the changes. With this kind of chart, you can discuss the inevitable changes. And when people ask you, how much will this program cost, you can ask them, when would you like us to re-estimate the product backlog? If your programs are anything like the programs I've worked on, they fall into a couple of categories. The first is the kind we have to do because they are critical to the organization's success. The big question is when we will release the darn thing, so we will adjust the roadmap and the backlog. The second is when we want to release the darn thing as quickly as possible because we need the money, darn it, so we have to play with the roadmap and the backlog to get the most value out of what we're doing. Do you have a third? Did you notice the common theme here? We will have to play with the roadmap and the backlog to get the most value out of the program? Notice I did not say ROI, return on investment. You cannot calculate ROI until after your release, so there's no point in trying to measure that right now. Your management might want you to measure earned value. Earned value is the value you derive from completed features. With earned value, your management might be able to capitalize the investment the program has made. You can show earned value with a product backlog burn-up chart. 10.5. Measure the product backlog burn-up. Figure 10.2 in the supplemental materials is the product backlog burn-up chart. This is where you take all the feature sets, plot them next to each other on one chart, and show how they might be done in relationship to each other. This product backlog burn-up chart is what we might have had for a product I worked on a long time ago, a voicemail system. Each part of the system has a different feature team working on it. We had different teams for each part of the system. Alarms, messages, payments, ringback, user, admin, and co-admin. We had more teams, but this is a simplified version of the chart. After the teams worked on the code for 5 interim releases, the chart looked like figure 10.3. The number of features increased over time for all the feature sets. Management was surprised when they saw the requirements growth. The product backlog burn-up chart shows feature growth with the height of each feature set in the chart. In a sense, this is a thermometer kind of chart for each feature set. You can see the completion of each feature set grow as the teams deliver code into the code base. 10.6. Measure the time to your releasable deliverable. Since what you care about is releasable product at the program level, measure the time to achieve it. Measure the time between releasable deliverables. Does the product go from releasable to not releasable? This is a predictive indicator, believe it or not. Because you are accustomed to releasing on a rhythm, your past time to release is a predictor of your future time to release. Unless you know how to shorten that time, it's not going to become shorter without significant effort. You can't get feedback in less time than your time to release. This is important to the program. If you release internally every month, and that release is good enough to ship, then your time to release is 30 days. If you have continuous delivery, you might measure your time to release in hours or minutes. If you do have a SaaS product, and you are not releasing in hours or minutes, you may have an impediment in your program. You as the program manager may need to help solve that problem. If your programs take longer than 30 days to release, why? That might be an impediment for your program. The longer it takes for you to release, the longer it takes for feedback to the product development teams. The larger your program, the more feedback you need. Measure it. 10.7. Measure release frequency. If your program starts releasing something internally every 2 weeks, and sometime later the program releases only once every 3 weeks, something bad has happened. The teams might have incurred technical debt without anyone realizing it. If your program starts releasing 5 times a day and builds up to releasing every 20 minutes, you might not have problems in the program. Your release frequency is an indication of how easy it is to release your product. You want internal release frequency high, regardless of your ability to externally release. 10.8. Measure build time. One indication that your program is healthy is the amount of time it takes to do a full build or a partial build. The lower the build time, the more frequently the developers will check in and build. The more frequently people check in and build, the more likely they are to do continuous integration. You can maintain momentum on your program. Be aware when build times increase. Or, if performance is a key feature of your product, be aware if certain scenarios have decreased performance or reliability. If you and the feature teams are aware of the build time and performance scenarios, everyone can know if something breaks. Measure build time as a trend. The teams might want to measure broken builds and time to fix a build as trends also. Build time measurements are an indication that the code is healthy or not. 10.9. Other potential measurements. You may need to take and provide other measurements for your sponsors or for your program team. 10.9.1. Measure run rate if you have a target budget. If you have a target budget, measure the run rate. The run rate is the amount of salary and overhead the program uses every week or iteration or every month. A cautionary note here, do not ask people to track their time by feature. It's rarely accurate. If the teams find value in that total team time per feature, they can measure it. They might measure it to see if they can make their feature smaller so they can obtain more throughput. As a program manager, I'm interested in the aggregate number of how much we spend per week or month, so I know where we are in relation to the target budget. That's the run rate. That also provides you the excuse to ask everybody, "You're not working on any other project or program, are you? Because I'm taking your salary hit on this program. So if you're working on something else, let me know." Multitasking is a disaster on a program. It's insidious and slows a program to a crawl faster than anything I know. 10.9.2. Consider cumulative flow to see work in progress. Depending on the number of teams, you might be able to look at cumulative flow or work in progress. The more teams you have, the more this entire graph can get too large to be effective. Each team can consider measuring its cumulative flow to make sure they don't have work in progress or inventory. 10.9.3. Consider a program-level obstacle report. You might track an obstacle report, as I suggest in my book, Manage Your Project Portfolio. Your feature teams want to know you are looking for and removing obstacles. They are impediments to your program. The program teams want to know also. As a program manager, your primary job is to facilitate the teams finishing their work. When feature teams see the program team's progress removing obstacles, they can see and feel your progress. That progress encourages them to bring you bad news and trust you to remove obstacles. When you make the obstacle report public, no managers can hide from their obstacle removal work. The managers have to commit to helping the program. Review Figure 10.4 in the supplemental materials for an example program obstacle report. 10.9.4. Consider other measures as diagnostic indicators. If your program feels stuck, you might want the teams to measure their fault feedback ratios as I discuss in my book, Manage It, Your Guide to Modern Pragmatic Project Management. You might want to measure code growth over time. If your future teams don't have small growth, that might be a problem. This is a team data point. You can measure code growth for the entire code base. You might want to see where the code growth is larger than expected to do some problem solving, not blaming. People grow code fast when they are under pressure. Learn why people are, or feel as if they are, under pressure. Do not blame them for being under pressure. If you see a high fault feedback ratio, look for bad news. Consider more options in How Servant Leaders Work from Section 11.3. You might want to track defects slash feature, although if you have many, I suggest doing something about that sooner rather than later. Your technical debt will get out of control very fast and reduce your momentum. Remember that incurring technical debt has a cost. If left unchecked, technical debt will prevent the teams from releasing because the features are not actually done. 10.10. Measure performance or reliability release criteria. I have worked on products where they existed because they provided a performance or reliability advantage over their competitors. One way to monitor that advantage is to build the measurements into the release criteria. Then create product measurements that allow you to monitor the competitive advantage with each build. Consider the following anecdote by a senior program manager. We learned to measure performance. I was the program manager for a database product. We sold it based on performance. I had the bright idea we should measure performance with an interim release about halfway through the program. The performance had degraded, so we were much worse than our competitors. I didn't ask why. I figured the developers and the architects would do that. But I did ask for each team to generate automated performance tests we could run against every build. We knew what the performance needed to be. If the performance was too slow, we could fix it then, not accumulate technical debt. That worked. We ended up with 8 scenarios. We had a preloaded database, so we could run the tests fast. We ran them and discovered problems as we proceeded. I wasn't so worried about the problems. I was worried about our not knowing about the problems until very late in the program. Having performance scenarios and running automated tests every build that represented those scenarios saved our collective tushes. 10.11. How to answer the when will you be done / how much will your program cost question. If your management constantly asks you for estimation, they don't trust you or the program. A request for estimation is also a measurement. It's a qualitative measurement of your influence on the managers and the teams. It's a measure of how much your management trusts you. Better you should know now when you can do something about it. Back in Ask These Questions Before Estimating from Section 9.2, I suggested you ask your sponsors about investment or value. You can see that with the approaches I've suggested, the program always has something to show your sponsors. You always have a walking skeleton. You always either had a demonstration within the last 2 weeks, or you have one coming up. If you have an agile roadmap the way I suggest, you even have at least a monthly release or a demo. You have a program product owner who continues to work in the roadmap. Armed with the roadmap and historical data about what the teams have delivered and the product backlog burn-up chart, you can ask the people who ask, when will your program be done, this question, what is of most value to you? Once we know what is of most value, we can work on that first. If the backlog is already ranked in value order, we can either take the time to estimate it, or I can provide an estimate with a confidence level in a couple of days. It's the same kind of answer with the cost question. The only problem is if these people ask before you started anything at all. That's really a project portfolio question. If your sponsors want your program to continue estimating either schedule or budget after you've started to show them a deliverable each month, ask why. Is your program's demonstrations a feature-based demonstration or a frameworks demo? Sponsors and customers don't buy frameworks. The team needs to deliver features. Can your sponsors see progress based on your program's demo, or are the teams developing as components instead of through the architecture? Sponsors and customers cannot see the value of components. They need to see features. Is there a target date or a target budget you need to know about? If so, you can manage that risk. If your sponsors want your program to spend time estimating instead of delivering, you can do that. In the past, I've explained that all the time we spend estimating is time we don't spend delivering. If you have agile or lean teams delivering features all the time, your sponsors will understand. 10.12 Principles 1. Measure at the program level, not at the project level. The principle is, build integrity in. 2. Measure what you want to see. You want completed features. You want releasable code. What else do you want? Measure that. Do not measure surrogates. The more you measure surrogates, the less you will get what you want. The principle is, working software is the primary measure of progress. 3. The feature teams are also responsible for their measurements. They need to measure what they do to know if they're going off the rails and if they have risks in their projects. The principle is, build projects around motivated individuals. Trust them to get the job done. 4. Ask for demonstrations. Remember in the manifesto, on the principles page, there is a line that says, working software is the primary measure of progress. Believe it. The more your product works, the fewer measurements you need. The principle is, working software is the primary measure of progress. Chapter 11. Develop your servant leadership. The senior people in Agile and Lean programs are servant leaders. The program product owner, the program managers, the program architect are all servant leaders. They guide and shepherd the business value of the program. They create the environment in which all teams and team members can contribute to the product. If you're unsure of what a servant leader is or how it changes how you work, this is the chapter for you. Servant leadership is an approach to managing and leading where the leader creates an environment in which people can do their best work. The leader doesn't control the work. The team does. The leader trusts the team to provide the desired results. Servant leaders put the needs of customers, employees, and communities first. This allows you to create an environment in which people come first. That creates business value when you ask for the results you want. 11.1. Program managers no longer drive the program. Some program managers have used this position to bully people into working faster, or to demand that teams complete some functionality by working overtime, or they would commit to a date or functionality without the teams knowing whether the work could be done, never mind in that time. One of my program managers once told a customer, "Sure, they can do that." We would have had to have bent the law of physics at the time. Our computers were too slow then. When organizations transition to Agile, the program manager might want to work as a servant leader. However, the manager might want to be command and control, or at least control. You might find it difficult to work as a servant leader in this situation. That makes it difficult to be a servant leader to the program and manage the manager's expectations. 11.2. Consider your servant leadership. In reality, you may work on a continuum from servant leadership to command and control leadership. I had a program product owner who was too busy to spend time iterating on the roadmaps for our program. I pinged him several times to update the roadmap. I explained the program was at risk. He had other work that appeared more important to him. I was concerned we would have no backlogs for the next month and no updated roadmap. I made an appointment for a one-on-one with him. We had a cordial conversation. No action on the roadmap. I saw him the next week and said, "You have 2 days to update the roadmap. If you don't, I'll get someone who will. You'll be off the program." He laughed at me. "I'll do it when I get around to it." I said, "Don't tempt me. 2 days." The 2 days came and went. I made an appointment with his boss and explained he was no longer on my program. Did the boss want to assign someone new, or could I have my pick of potential program product owners? His boss wanted me to give the guy a second chance. No, no way. I got my new program product owner. We had an updated roadmap and a new backlog. You might think I was not so serving in this instance. I didn't yell or swear. I admit to some eye-rolling. I served greater needs of the program. Being a servant leader does not mean you're a pushover. It means you create the environment in which people can thrive and the feature teams can work with autonomy, collaboration, and exploration. If people don't know what to do, they certainly cannot deliver. 11.3. How Servant Leaders Work. In his book, The Case for Servant Leadership, Kent Keith defines 7 practices of servant leaders. 1. They are self-aware. 2. They listen. 3. They serve the people who work for them. Keith calls this changing the pyramid. 4. They help other people grow. 5. They coach people, not control them. 6. They unleash the energy and intelligence of others. 7. They work to develop their foresight so they can act, not react. Program servant leaders act as stewards of the program environment. They might protect the teams from interference. They facilitate the team's work. For more information on servant leadership, see A Journey into the Nature of Legitimate Power and Greatness, 25th Anniversary Edition by Robert K. Greenleaf. When you ask the teams for the results you want, when you create the environment in which the teams can deliver those results, and when you manage by exception, you are a servant leader. Here's how you might use these practices. Our managers ask us to be program managers, program architects, or program product owners because we have shown our expertise or competence in the past. When we are self-aware, we don't need to be the smartest or the best technical person. Instead, we're aware of our strengths and how we can manage our weaknesses. When we listen and decide that our job is to serve the people in the program, what matters is how people can finish their work. It matters that everyone has the capacity to do their jobs, that we listen for and remove impediments. We may be the technical leader for some part of the program. Program architects often discover they are technical leaders. One of the most valuable actions for a servant leader is to help other people use our expertise to improve the product or the program. When we coach people instead of specifying their work, we help them learn and grow. When we deliberate about how to create an environment in which people can be most successful, we have 2 opportunities. The first is that we unleash everyone else's capabilities. They can be even more successful. The other is that we have the opportunity to see the program as a whole and act before risks become problems. 11.4. Some people don't want servant leadership. When I coach managers and architects to improve their servant leadership, some people say, "But some people want me to tell them what to do. They don't want a servant leader. They want a commanding leader." If you hear that, review your program and corporate culture. Are your managers telling you how to work? If so, you might feel as if you need to tell others how to do their work. Do your managers blame you for making mistakes? If so, do you blame the people on the program if a risk comes true or someone makes a mistake? Agile and lean provide transparency for everything. The work, the status, who is doing what. If your organization is still blaming people for mistakes, you might have trouble being a servant leader. My advice is to start by protecting the program. The following is an anecdote from a software program manager where Agile is still new. I am the wall around the program. We're sort of agile. We have the idea of iterations, and we use Kanban to see our work in progress. We're not perfect at getting to done all the time, and our management still blames us if we don't make their imposed deadlines. I decided the best way I could serve the software program was to protect the feature teams. I begged the program product owner to define reasonable interim deliverables, and I would protect the feature teams from what I called management mayhem. My boss came over to me about halfway through the program and said, "I don't think your program is making enough progress. What are you going to do about it?" I replied, "Nothing. I can't do anything about it. The teams are working to their maximum capacity. I need to change your mind and the other managers' minds about what we can accomplish in a month. Your expectations are not in line with reality." He looked puzzled. I dragged him over to the product backlog burn-up chart and the total feature burn-up chart and explained that management had added more and more features without adding more time. How realistic is this? I've been telling you for weeks now, you can add what you want, but the total time has to change. We're not magicians. You can see our progress is steady. Your additions are exponential. That's nuts. He finally understood, because of my charts. He agreed that management had unreasonable expectations. I was the only one he spoke with, which made me happy. I get paid to deal with management, not to let the nonsense roll downhill. I was able to protect the program, which for me was an act of servant leadership. 11.5. Welcome bad news. Part of listening is to welcome bad news, not just all news. As program managers, we prefer to know that everything is going just fine. Few programs speed along with no bumps. When you make it easy for people to bring you bad news, you can hear and see the actual program status. You cannot be everywhere and hear everything. You, as a program manager, have an obligation to see what's happening in your program, good and bad. Your problem is, how can you observe what teams do? Once you can see them, you might be able to generate several options for helping people bring you bad news. 11.5.1. Visit every team wherever they are. I recommend you visit the feature teams. If you are all in one city or on one campus, consider management by walking around and listening, MBWAL. If people know you're wandering around every Tuesday and Thursday, as an example, they know they have an opportunity to discuss issues with you. You might even send an email. I intend to wander around starting at 4 p.m. on Thursday. Let me know if you would like me to drop by your team and discuss anything. If the feature teams are all over the world, visit the teams who are remote from you at least once a quarter. Depending on the duration of your program, that might not be often enough. Yes, travel is time-consuming and can be expensive. It's more expensive to have insufficient communication and defects. 11.5.2. Watch your facial expressions. We all react to good and bad news. How you react can change the conversation. Consider the following anecdote by an experienced program manager. Think of bad news as an opportunity. I had a program where two feature teams consistently missed their deliverables. Marcom was too busy with other things. I wanted to pull my hair out. One day, when I was tired, I grimaced and frowned at a program team meeting. The program product owner later asked me, "Do you want to hear bad news?" I said, "Of course." "If you don't watch your facial expressions, you won't hear it," he said. Uh-oh. I reframed how I thought of bad news to an opportunity for improvement. I explained what I did at the next program team meeting. I would like to reframe our bad news into opportunities to improve. I welcome your bad news, and we will work together to capitalize on opportunities. I decided I could look serious, but not upset. I started to say, "That's an opportunity for problem solving." It was corny, but it worked. I heard more bad news than I thought I could stomach, and we solved those problems fast. Sometimes a change in your mindset can change your expressions. Sometimes your expression can change your mindset. Make sure you're open to opportunities, even though sometimes those opportunities look like problems. 11.5.3. Consider an anonymous email box for suggestions. I don't normally like anonymous emails with suggestions. I would rather have a conversation. On the other hand, if people are having trouble and you don't hear about it, consider an anonymous email system. People can then email their concerns. If you work in a low-trust environment where you need an anonymous email box, you might have trouble with using Agile for your program. You can develop more trust by being transparent about your work and delivering frequently. The more you deliver your work, fixing impediments, solving problems, acquiring resources such as labs, whatever your program needs, the more your program will trust you. 11.6. Use the growth mindset. Carol Dweck describes the growth mindset in her book, Mindset: The New Psychology of Success. To see the difference between fixed mindsets and growth mindsets, please refer to Figure 11.1, Comparison of Fixed and Growth Mindset, in the supplemental materials. Agile and Lean lend themselves to the growth mindset. Teams learn early by experimenting and discovering what works and what doesn't work. If you decide you need to coach people on the program team or in the feature teams, consider using the growth mindset to help people see that they can succeed. They might need to learn how, and they can learn to do so. 11.7. Ask for the results you want. People live up or down to your expectations. If you expect the teams to ask you to solve each problem, they will. If you create a hierarchy where teams have to check with a quasi-manager, such as a scrum master or an agile project manager, they will. Instead, imagine what would happen if you say to the teams, please solve problems across the organization when you can, using your small world networks and communities of practice. People would talk to other people. They might email, IM, use whatever program/project wiki or electronic space you provide for collaboration. You can't know in advance what they will solve or not solve. People and teams can still use their program manager, scrum master, or project manager to help solve problems. But when you ask people to solve problems and don't second-guess them, they will. Remember, you have adults working on your program. They pretty much know how to dress themselves, rent an apartment, or buy a house and raise children. They solve problems now. Expect them to do so at work. When you ask people to solve problems, you can magnify momentum in your program. Here are some guidelines I've found useful. 11.7.1. Set expectations for being stuck. Ask people to define how long they will work alone before they ask for help in their teams or across the organization. My suggestion for this time is 30 minutes. That might seem short to you. I have found that if people spend a solid 30 minutes being stuck, as in they cannot think of an experiment to try, or their search for an answer is fruitless, they stop working on the problem and read email or surf the web. They spend much more than 30 minutes being stuck. If they don't ask someone to pair or ask the team to swarm on a problem once they've spent 30 minutes being stuck, the chances increase that they will spend a full day being stuck. They won't say anything until the stand-up, and even then they might be reluctant to say anything in public. Instead, if people have a guideline about being stuck, they may act before the day is gone. You, as a program manager, can show others how to ask for help. Even if you don't need help, ask for it. When you set the example, people are more likely to ask for help. 11.8. Principles of Develop Your Servant Leadership. 1. Trust the people on the program team and the features team to do their jobs. The principle is build projects around motivated individuals. Trust them to get the job done. 2. Look for and remove impediments that people cannot remove themselves. The principle is empower the team. 3. Discover ways to encourage the teams to do better or more than you can imagine. The principle is the best architectures, requirements, and designs emerge from self-organizing teams. Chapter 12. Shepherd the Agile Architecture. One of the big problems in Agile and Lean program management is how to manage the product's architecture. If you don't shepherd the architecture, you end up with a mess. If you create frameworks before you have features, you will be wrong. You might have significant rework, not refactoring, late in the program. Architecture throughout the program is the way we manage that risk. The risks of deciding on the frameworks up front are considerable in the program. On the other hand, no architectural guidance might be a disaster in your program. Consider how your program can create an iterative and incremental approach to architecture. Also, consider when is the most responsible moment to decide on the product's architecture and the frameworks. Back in How Often Can You Release Your Product? From Section 6.4, you saw the potential for release frequency based on the kind of product you have. Now consider when to make architectural decisions. Refer to Figure 12.1 in the supplemental materials. The closer your product is to SaaS, the longer you can wait to make many architectural decisions. You might have to make product guidance and architectural decisions, but you often don't have to make many large upfront design decisions. The closer your product is to the right side of the continuum with hardware, the more you might have to use set-based design approaches or provide more architectural guidance earlier. The program architect should not decide alone. The program architect works with feature teams and other architects across the program to collaborate and decide when to select which frameworks. That makes your program architect's job one of shepherding the business value of the architecture, which is a social and collaborative role requiring communications. The program architect helps facilitate the autonomy, collaboration, and